And now we're reading the Bhagavad Gita. And what section are you on in the Bhakti Shastri? Number 9. Any specific part of number 9?
There was a verse that we did today, and which talked about that Lord Krishna is the ultimate receiver of the sacrifice, which we also read just now in Sri Upanishad. And Kishore Prabhu had asked a question, so you might as well answer it since you. I'm just going to put the question to you.
Okay.
And let me just get the exact verse number for you. Just give me a minute here.
Hum kraturaham jagya swaraham hama aushadam mantraham hame bhaktyam aham agnir aham hutam.
Verse number 24.
Aham hi sarva jagnanam bhukta cha prabhureva natumam abhijananti tatvina tashtyavanti te. Aham, I, he, surely, sarva, of all, jagnanam, sacrifices, bhokta, the enjoyer, cha, and, prabhu, the Lord, eva, also, cha, and, na, not, to, but, mam, me, abhijananti, they know. Tatvena, in reality. Ataha, therefore. Shavanti, fall down. Te, they. Translation together. I am the only enjoyer and master of all sacrifices. Therefore, those who do not recognize my true transcendental nature fall down. Purport. Here it is clearly stated that there are many types of yajna performances recommended in the Vedic literatures, but actually all of them are meant for satisfying the Supreme Lord. Yajna means Vishnu. In the 3rd chapter of Bhagavad Gita, it is clearly stated that one should only work for satisfying yajna or Vishnu. The perfectional form of human civilization known as Varnashram Dharma is specifically meant for satisfying Vishnu. Therefore, Krishna says in this verse, I am the enjoyer of all sacrifices because I am the Supreme Master. Less intelligent persons, however, without knowing this fact, worship demigods for temporary benefit. Therefore, they fall down to material existence and do not achieve the desired goal of life. If, however, anyone has any material desire to be fulfilled, he had better pray for it to the Supreme Lord, although that is not pure devotion, and he will thus achieve the desired result. Question.
The question was that if Lord Krishna is the enjoyer and master of all kinds of sacrifices, then in the Vedas there are some sacrifices mentioned which are animal sacrifices. So when a person does animal sacrifices, does Krishna take that offering of an animal? Yeah. This was asked by Kishore Prabhu, who was asking this question in the morning.
Prabhupada mentions that the animal sacrifices that are done in the Vedas are to prove the efficacy of the Vedic mantras, and that the animal that's killed in the sacrifice is then brought back to life with the mantras. It's given a new, fresh body. And it's not that the animal itself is being offered, you know, for some kind of, you know, somebody to eat or something like that. That's what Prabhupada says about animal sacrifices in the Vedas, because it comes up in reference to Lord Buddha, and that he came and preached ahimsa, nonviolence. He told everyone to stop the Vedic sacrifices because people who couldn't bring animals back to life just, you know, were doing sacrifices. And then they also use it as an excuse, just like the Qazi, when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came to his house, he told him that, you know, he accused the Qazi of being a cow killer, you're killing your mother. And then the Qazi said, yeah, but in the Vedas, there's animal sacrifices. And Mahaprabhu said, yeah, that's for bringing life back to the animal. It's not meant for, you know, killing the animal unnecessarily. But as time goes by, the rituals become degraded and the understanding behind them become degraded, and people use this as an excuse. Just like in Mormonism, it says that they follow three regulator principles. That is chastity and no intoxication, no gambling. And the meat eating part, Joseph Smith, the founder of the church, said that meat should be taken sparingly and in times of famine. But they've screwed a different meaning out of it. Now they say meat eating should be done moderately. And it's a completely different meaning, because sparingly means not at all, except in times of emergency, just like when you have a spare tire. You don't drive around on it, do you? And if you have a flat tire, you can put it on for a few blocks, but that's it. So, however, because people are inclined, let me look up this verse. This is an important verse in the 11th canto. It's a verse in the 11th canto, which is on page 270. Lokev yavaya misha madhyaseva nitya hi jantorna hi tatra chodana vivastiti isteshu vivaha jagnya suragrahar asu nivritta ishta. In this material world, the conditioned soul is always inclined to sex, meat eating, and intoxication. Therefore, religious scriptures never actually encourage such activities. Although the scriptural injunctions provide for sex through sacred marriage, for meat eating through sacrificial offerings, and for intoxication through the acceptance of ritual cups of wine, such ceremonies are meant for the ultimate purpose of renunciation. Spoken by Chamasa Yogendra, who was instructing King Nimi. Is that right?
Where he was coming from was basically he mentioned Goddess Kali. Mm-hmm. And he said that people offer meat to Goddess Kali and then they eat it. And
it as Kali Prasad.
As Kali Prasad.
It's bogus.
And what he was saying was, and here in the purport of the verse, it mentions that Krishna says that people do not know that he's the enjoyer of all sacrifices, so they foolishly offer things to demigod, but it actually gets offered to him. So in that context, he was saying that if a person offers meat to Kali, then does Krishna have to accept it because it comes through the demigod that way? And there was also Gandhavreka Mataji suggested that maybe in that case, Krishna doesn't really eat the meat. What he's really looking is the austerities. A person who is having a desire to eat meat, the austerities, he has to go through that. Because if you really want to eat meat, you can always go out to the corner and eat the meat. But instead of that, he's going through the efforts of going and getting an animal, going through the process of sacrifice and then eating it. So he's really looking at that part. So those were some of the thoughts that were expressed.
First of all, Krishna is not obliged to accept anything. It's not that there's a sacrifice, and because there's a sacrifice, he's obliged to accept it. And there are sacrifices which are in the lower modes of material nature, and that are in that sense they're disconnected, just as the whole material world is disconnected from Krishna. So, the ultimate purpose of the sacrifices is for the purification. And I mean, there are provisions for people in lower modes of material nature to perform certain kinds of sacrifice, because that's all they can do to start with. Just like when Narada Muni was coming through the forest, he met Magrari the hunter. Welcome. Thank you for coming. Thank you. Magrari was a hunter, and he was half killing animals. And when Narada Muni saw a deer that was half killed and then a boar that was half killed, he wanted to find out who was doing this, Hare Krishna. And he saw this hunter in the forest who was killing the animals. Heath, welcome back. Sunny, can you give everyone zafus so they can be more comfortable? They're piled behind the door. We have zafus for everybody, if you like. It'll make you more comfortable. And there's also chairs, too, if you like. So please make yourselves at home. Thanks for coming. So when Narada saw the hunter, he told him that. He said, why are you half killing the animals when you kill them all the way? He didn't say immediately, he didn't tell them to stop killing animals. He said, at least stop half killing them. He said, you're a hunter, I can understand why you're killing animals. It's your livelihood. Why do you half kill them? You're going to get a lot more suffering and reaction because of that. So similarly, my point is that there may be rituals that are offered in the Vedas, advice for people, just as this verse is pointing out, ritual cups of wine, other kinds of sacrifices that are, their ultimate purpose is not for, Krishna's pleasure. It's meant to reform the person gradually, who's in the lower modes of material nature, so they can adhere to some kind of sacrifice, because then at least it regulates it, and it comes up to, the next position.
So I think the key point that I'm going to take away from here is that Krishna is not obligated to take everything that we offer via a demigod or directly to him if it is not in the right...
Yeah, this is a karma mimamsa philosophy. In the karma mimamsa philosophy, they say that they say that the Vedic sounds are absolute, and if you perform the sacrifice, then you have to get the result. It'll just come automatically. But the idea of Krishna being the supreme joyer is not that there's some automatic result, but it's his prerogative ultimately. Yeah.
Because we were literally following that, if a person is foolish and instead of watering the root offers the water to the branches. I mean, if you put the water on the branches, some of it does fall down to the roots and does go get into the tree. And that way we were thinking that, if it's the meat kind of thing that you're offering, does it still go to Krishna? But I think the key point that you mentioned is that Krishna is not obligated to take everything. So I think that would be the best way to address this.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you, Prabhu.
But yet Koroshi Rashnoshi Yach Johoshi Dadasi Yat. This is a later verse in the Bhagavad Gita. Tapasasti Kuntiya Tat Kurushwaban Arpadam. Krishna does say, whatever you do, whatever you eat, whatever you offer and give away, should do as a sacrifice to me. That includes, wherever you start. And it doesn't mean Krishna doesn't need any offerings from anybody. Prahlad Maharaj points this out in his prayers to Lord Nrsimhadev. In the seventh canto of the Bhagavatam, where he says that Krishna's complete in himself, and whatever offerings are made are done for the benefit, are for the benefit of the person who offers them. And Krishna doesn't need them, but he accepts them. So it's not like he's accepting some physical thing, but as indicated very precisely in Patram Pushpam Palam Toyam Yome Bhaktya Prayachati Taraham Bhakti Paritam Ashnami Paritatmanaha. The only thing Krishna is really interested in the offering is bhakti. And so that's what he's accepting is the love. Because what does he need an apple for? He created it. But if there is some feeling behind the offering somehow or other, that gets directed towards Krishna, then he accepts that. But it's not a mechanical thing where, he's obligated to accept whatever old thing somebody offers it to him.
When it says in text 24, the translation is, therefore those who do not recognize my true transcendental nature fall down.
Mm-hmm.
If you were saying that Krishna wants bhakti, does that mean that it has... I think I wanted to know what's the quality where it's a positive reaction. Like people that just kind of pray impersonally, like they pray to God. They're not using Krishna's name, but like in their hearts they're trying to thank God for this plate of food that they have or thank him for something around them. Is that a positive reaction that they get from that? Because they're not really understanding Krishna. They're not necessarily offering it to him with pure devotional you know, love in their hearts, but do they get any type of good reaction?
Well, that's okay. Krishna's hard to understand. Even Brahma said, after he studied all the Vedas and he saw Krishna, and he said, other people may say they know Krishna, but as far as I'm concerned, I don't know anything about Krishna. So, but yes, that's bhakti. This process, you know, the Muslims have this program of bowing down 5 times a day. This is a form of bhakti. Bhakti is shravanam, kirtanam, vishnu, smaranam, parasevanam, archanam, bandhanam, dasam, sakyam, atmanivedanam. There are various processes, direct processes of offering our love to God. One of them is bowing down our head. There's offering food. So somebody doesn't have a clear conception, but has some kind of faith that there's a supreme. And, you know, they feel, I'll offer this. I'll give you an example. Gajendra was an elephant. And in his previous life, he had been Indradumna, a king. And because of an offense in his next life, because of an offense to a sage, it wasn't a very severe offense, but the sage cursed him and said, in your next life, you can become a dumb animal. So he became an elephant. But in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, anyone who does good is never overcome by evil. In other words, whatever progress you make, you know, it's maintained. So no matter where you end up, if you make 50% progress in this life, next life you take up 50% at that level. So Gajendra, although he is an elephant, when he was captured by the crocodile, when he went into the lake and was being dragged down, he struggled for 100 years with this crocodile. He, out of desperation, began to offer prayers to the Supreme. He didn't even know who the Supreme was at that time, and he also didn't know where the prayers came from. They were prayers he had practiced in his previous life, and he didn't even know who he was saying it to, but there was a feeling in his heart that he was in desperation, and, you know, like they say, there's no atheists in foxholes. You get into a tough, anybody gets into a really dangerous situation and realize I could die, and then, you know, please help me, whoever it is. Gajendra was like that. And the demigods heard his prayers, and they listened carefully, and they said, those aren't for us. they're meant for the Supreme Being. So after that, a Krishna came, and he rescued Gajendra, actually, one of Krishna's expansions. So came and rescued Gajendra. So his prayers weren't specific, but the feeling of bhakti was there. So much so that Prahlad Maharaj, when he, as a 5-year-old boy, had been pushed forward to offer prayers to Lord Nrsingadev. Lord Nrsingadev came and was killed Hiranyakashipu, the great atheist demon who had tortured his son, his 5-year-old son, who was a great devotee. And when Nrsingadev came, he was so angry in that form. He's the half-man, half-lion incarnation of Krishna. He wouldn't calm down. And the demigods, who know perfect Sanskrit and meter and know how to offer prayers, came before him, and they all tried, each one of them. Even Lakshmi Devi tried, and still Nrsingadev was not pacified at all. So then Brahma suggested, Prahlad, he came for you. Prahlad said, I don't know any prayers. I don't know any Sanskrit. I don't know anything. I was born from I'm the one, you know, from his seed. I'm a demon. But then he remembered Gajendra. And he said, Bhaktya tu tosha bhagavan gajayutapaya. He said, the king of the elephants, Gajendra, he offered prayers. And he was a big elephant. What did he know? But because he was sincere when he offered the prayers, Krishna accepted it. So he said, therefore I should try. And he said, this should be the mark of each person. If you sincerely try to please Krishna, this is the point. You know, if there's that sincerity within the heart, and one offers prayers. Devotees in the West, when Srila Prabhupada brought the process of devotional service here, would offer prayers, but you could barely distinguish what those prayers were because the pronunciation is so different and incorrect. You know, one word is Vande Goro Shri. They would say, you know, they're offering obeisances to the cow, not to the spiritual master. You know, but Prabhupada said, because the sincerity was there, Krishna will not discount that. He'll accept the, the feeling that's behind it. Bhava Grahi Janardana. He's called the Lord who accepts what the bhava is, what the feeling is behind it. So ultimately, yes, that's accepted and it's considered devotion. And the gold standard, however, if you study the science carefully, is to come to the position which is mentioned by Suta Goswami in the Srimad Bhagavatam. He says, Savai pum samparo dharmo yato bhaktir hoksaji ahaitukya pratyata yayatma supersediti. He suggests that the supreme occupation for all humanity is that by which men can attain to loving devotional service unto the Supreme Lord. And he says, such devotional service must be unmotivated and uninterrupted in order to completely satisfy the self. So there are people all over the world, Hare Krishna, who are devoted to God in one way or another. And the particular kind of ritual, the external trappings are not what's important, but the gold standard is ahaituki apratiyata. That means unmotivated service and uninterrupted. In other words, unmotivated means I'm not asking for something. It's service for service. When Lord Nrsingadev offered benedictions to Prahlad, he said, take a benediction. Take whatever you want. Prahlad said, I'm not a vanik. I'm not a merchant. I didn't offer my service to you because I wanted something in return. I don't want a benediction. I just want to serve. And Lord Nrsingadev said, no, take a benediction. Finally, Prahlad Maharaj says, if you want to offer any benediction, then let it be that from within the core of my heart, there's no material desire. This is unmotivated service, service for service. There's nothing behind it that I want something. Otherwise, the standard of the Bhagavat, the Srimad Bhagavatam, is dharma prochita kaitavotra paramo nirmatsaranam satam. This is for those who are completely free from envy, and that their standard is that they don't want anything. Anything else besides that is considered cheating. Kaitava. It means you're cheating. You want something in return. It's spoiled. To the degree that you want something in return, it's spoiled. Somebody gives you something, right? Like someone writes you a nice letter, and in the letter they say, you know, you're so kind, and you're so nice, and you're so intelligent, and you're the nicest person I ever met. And in the last line they say, by the way, can I borrow your lawnmower? And then you think, they didn't mean any of that. They just wanted my lawnmower. Could be that they meant all those things, but still, if you perceive some kind of motivation behind it, then you become disheartened. If there's no motivation behind the offering, then it's powerful. And so this is the standard. You know, we have to see, what is it? What are we asking? We're not asking. Yes. Silly question. We give $100 for silly questions, but let me see if I have $100 on me.
Okay. Well, the motivation that you were saying, that when we do bhakti without motivation, does it also include if we pray to Krishna that we want to come back home? Is that a motivation also, like for sense, for our self-gratification?
Well, in this, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, na dhanam, na janam, na sundarim, kavitam va jagadisha kamaye, mama janmani janmani shvare bhavatad bhaktira haituki twai. His standard of devotion was very high. He said that I don't want wealth, I don't want women, I don't want followers, I don't want great, you know, I don't need great learning, and I also don't want liberation. I don't even care if I get liberated from this world. Chaku dan di loye janme janme prabhushe. We sing in the prayers to the spiritual master. Chaku dan, the person, chuk dan means that it was a gift of what? Chaku, vision. He gave me the vision how to go back, how to serve Krishna. Chaku dan di loye janme janme prabhushe. I want to serve him birth after birth. In other words, the devotee's saying that he's not saying, I want to go back to Godhead. He's saying, I want to serve birth after birth. Narayana parak sarve nakutashchana pibiti swarga pavarga narakeshu apituliana darshana. A devotee doesn't care in heaven, hell, whatever situation he or she is in. Main point is service. I want to do service. At the same time, it's not a material desire to want to go back home, back to Godhead. But the devotee really wants to serve Krishna according to Krishna's desire. I mean, it's not a material desire. And Prabhupada was asked specifically about that and indicated that, you know, we should desire to go back to Godhead. Tishtan vraje tananuraga jananugami. That means that the advanced devotee should desire to live in Vrindavan, or should live in Vrindavan. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu told Sanatana Goswami that even if you can't live in Vrindavan physically, you should live there within your mind. And in his instructions to Rupa Goswami, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu told that when we get the seed of bhakti in our heart and we water it with what? Hearing and chanting. Shravanadi jal. It means that the hearing about Krishna and chanting about Krishna is water on the seed. That seed will sprout and it grows from our heart and it grows out through the universe, through the universal coverings, which are vast. And then it breaks through the Viraja River, which is the demarcation between the material and spiritual world, comes out into the spiritual world up to Goloka Vrindavan, the topmost planet in the spiritual world, and every creeper must have something to entwine itself upon. And so the creeper of devotional service entwines itself around the lotus feet of Krishna. And the devotee who's achieved this still lives in this world, but at the same time is living in Goloka Vrindavan. Externally, such an advanced devotee goes on performing regulated devotional service externally for the example of everyone else. Internally, that devotee is relishing pastimes with Krishna in the spiritual world. So as we continue to advance in devotional service, that desire to go back to Godhead is fulfilled even while one is in this world. There were instances, Prabhupada told us every year to come to Mayapur to meet him, to spend time with him in the Dham. So all the devotees would go, almost all the devotees. We left a few pujaris behind. And everyone else would go, and then we'd meet Prabhupada in the Dham. And sometimes there were, I remember one year there were some book distributors in Germany who were very famous for their book distribution, and they didn't come. And Prabhupada asked where they were, and they told Prabhupada that they didn't want to come. They were so absorbed in their service, they wanted to keep serving, they didn't want to come. Prabhupada said, oh, this is very good. This is like a high level of advancement. That you're so absorbed in your service, you may think, I don't want to go off the battlefield. I want to stay here and serve my spiritual master. Forget liberation. Just let me, you know. But someone who was serving to that level, Iha yasya harer dasye kanamana manasa gira nikila api avastasu jivan mukta su ujite. Such a person is liberated even in this body because he's using everything in Krishna's service. It's a really long answer to a short question, but it's not a material desire to want to go back to Godhead. But as with everything else in the spiritual world, there are unlimited degrees of variegatedness. Is that ambiguous enough for you? Okay. We can make it at least till 8 anyway. Bhagavad Gita. So you're studying chapter 9 now for Bhakti Shastri? Completed it. Okay. Are there any other questions? Probably not, because Srivas Pandit probably answered them all. Didn't leave anything for me. Well, that's the nature of hearing and chanting. When you hear and chant intensely, just when I was in Los Angeles, I just got back on Monday, Whenever I'm there, I always call ahead to arrange to meet with my, you know, favorite God brothers and hearing and chanting partners. Mukunda Datta was there. He's such a wonderful devotee. He's a certified pundit. He's very expert at Sanskrit. And he knows the Shastra very well. Such a nice devotee to hear and chant with. Banabhatta Prabhu was there. And one day we had the garden was full. That one day, and Bhakta George and Raina were there also. And we were hearing and chanting. What I find when you hear and chant in the association of advanced devotees, then one benefit you come out with is you have a lot more questions than when you came in. Spiritual life is unlimited. There's not a plateau where you go, I got it. Okay, that's it. Finished. But it's more, the more you know, the more you know you don't know. But it's all relishable. And the more you hear and chant in the Association of Advanced Devotees, there are deeper levels of meaning and understanding which call to you. And when you walk away in that state of mind, then you're hungry. And not only that, it's like your mind's on alert. Your mind and heart is on alert. And so when you hear in that state, Louis Pasteur said that great discoveries come unto only the prepared mind. So in this kind of preparation, hearing and hearing and chanting and chanting, then there's a way in which our mind is open and ready to hear and hungry. We should feel like that. One of the symptoms of advancement in spiritual life is avyarta kalatvam, which means that one does not feel comfortable wasting even a second outside of Krishna's service. And therefore, that devotee arranges his or her life in an orbit so that there's no, at no time is the devotee out of contact with the process of hearing and chanting or some kind of service to Krishna. The devotee feels very uneasy. Much the way, an alcoholic feels when the prospect of the bottle's running out, he starts scheming. Like, you know, I got to get some more money and I have to, you know, go get another bottle. Prabhupada gave this example when Prajapati asked him on a morning walk at Venice Beach, and he asked Prabhupada about how to get a taste for the holy name. And Prabhupada said, just the way drunkards get a taste for drinking. So you go and you associate with somebody who's expert at drinking. And after a while, you know, you'll take a drink, and then you learn how to drink a lot, and then you learn how to fall down on the ground and sleep on a bench and all kinds of things. Wake up and do it all over again. And Prajapati said, you want us to become drunkards on the holy name, Prabhupada? Prabhupada said, yes. Any other question about chapter 9? Oh, Srivas Prabhu, yes.
Last verse of the chapter 9, the question was that why is it that Krishna asking us to do four things? One thing might be sufficient enough, but he's asking us to do four things, and is there a reason behind that? That was the question. Is engage your mind and thinking of me, becoming my devotee, offer obeisances unto me, and worship me. So are they four separate or why? So that was the question.
Well, we have different senses, and all the senses should be or can be engaged in Krishna's service. Man, mana, bhavamad bhakto madhyaji mam namaskuru, mami vaishyasi yukvaiva manama parayana. So, man, mana, of course, the mind, engaged in thinking of me. This is the most important of all, because the mind is the reservoir of all changes, and is what drags me from one body to the next in the material world. It has fearsome godlike powers over the soul, actually. And the first goal of yoga, Yoga Sutra says one must control the mind. And Krishna says as much in the Bhagavad Gita also. And Krishna is like mango sap. You ever play in a mango tree? You ever cut a mango branch? Did you ever get mango sap on you? Does it come off? Not very easily, right? It burns and it stays in there. It's, you get it on your clothes, it's, you're finished, right? Did you ever climb in a mango tree? Did you ever get mango sap on you? Did it come out very easily? It gets in you, right? So Krishna is like mango sap. And if once you think of Krishna, if you practice thinking of Krishna, it's like mango sap. He'll stick in your brain, stick in your mind. Manmara. So practice thinking of Krishna, and actually, he'll stick in there. Bhavamad bhakto, and become my devotee. That's to become a devotee. Really, that's an all-encompassing kind of thing. There are many things that are involved in that. That covers. Because everyone's devoted to something or someone. It's the nature of the material world. Prabhupada talks about, Krishna talks about it in the 17th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, that's our nature, to be devoted somewhere. But as I'm covered by the three modes of material nature in different combinations and permutations, then that original devotion to Krishna gets perverted into, you know, all kinds of other devotion. I'm a devotee of the border collie. Save the border collie, or whatever other cause. And problem is, being devoted to so many good causes, we miss the great cause. There are many good causes. Anyone can come and say, "Oh, I do this, I do that." These are good causes. But what's the greatest cause? So don't miss the greatest cause by being devoted to good causes. The greatest cause is to become Krishna's devotee. Krishna's devotee, Ramananda Roy said, is the most famous in the world. He said, who's the most famous? Lord Chaitanya asked Ramananda Roy. He said, the most famous person in the world is the pure devotee. It's the rarest thing too. Muktanam apisidhanam narayana parayana. Sudulabha prashantatma Sarushrapi Mahamune. It's very rare in this world to find someone who's completely devoted, that's become a devotee. So if you want the greatest cause, it's to become a devotee of Krishna. Manmana bhavamad bhakto madhyaji. And worship. Everyone also then, of course, performs some kind of worship. Elvis Presley. It was a worshipable icon in America. Still going on. There was a radio station that played Elvis Presley. I don't know if it's still there, but used to play Elvis Presley 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Some people listen to it. And his house is still there in Graceland, the house that Elvis lived in, the king. And people still go there on pilgrimage. And they go there, it's hallowed ground. They go to see Elvis. And they get an Elvis picture, they get Elvis soap, they get an Elvis cigarette lighter, they get an Elvis bobble thing that goes on their car. I mean, they're devoted. It's natural to be devoted. But Krishna says, and that's a kind of worship also, isn't it? You get a picture, you know, that's how you worship. So Krishna says, worship me. Manjani namaskuru, and bowing down. Which is, it's the only time that the head is lower than the heart. All the other time, the head, Krishna talks about this in the Bhagavad Gita. Indriyani prayanyahur indriyebhya paramanaha manasastu parabhudir yo budhe paratastusaha. There's a hierarchy. Lowest of all is the sense objects. Above that are the senses that perceive the sense objects. Above the sense objects is the mind. Above the mind is the intelligence. And above the intelligence is the soul. The intelligence is always going around saying, yeah, can you measure it? Can I measure it? I met a guy, I was in the question answer booth, Los Angeles. I was talking about, I didn't talk about reincarnation, I don't think, or maybe I did, but he brought it up. He said, where is it proven scientifically about reincarnation? And I said, well, first of all, let's establish what you mean by scientific and what you'll accept as proof. Anyway, he wanted to argue about it, and I could see he was really stuck on this thing. It's like, I have to see it. I have to prove it, physically. I asked him, do you have a mind? And he said, yes, I have a mind. He said, do you think I have a mind? And he said, yeah, I think you have a mind. I said, can you see it? He goes, no. I said, can you prove it's there? You said it's there, but can you prove it? But the intelligence is such that it wants to measure everything. It wants to grab everything and say, okay, I've got it. But you can't do that with Krishna. Krishna is beyond the mind. He's adhoksaja. He is all the letters from A to Ksha in the alphabet, in Sanskrit alphabet. They describe something in this world, and there's a way in which by describing it, then I can understand it, I can grasp it with my intelligence. Krishna is adhoksaja. He's beyond all of the descriptions that you can make in the alphabet. You can't measure him with your mind. He's beyond that. So when you bow down, actually, you're taking your intelligence, your mind, supposedly it's situated somewhere here, figuratively, and you put it on the ground, and then the heart, which can actually understand Krishna, is placed in a higher position. And so this is a way of intuiting and understanding Krishna through submission. And the whole of the process of devotional service is really about submission. The more one is submissive to Krishna, then the more Krishna reveals himself. And it's natural, isn't it? The more somebody's submissive to you, don't you reveal your secrets to them? Or if somebody challenges you and you think that, you know, as soon as you tell them something, they're going to write an open letter against you on the internet. Here's an open letter. They didn't bother to ask you. They just put it out there for everyone to read. You know, if you think they're going to do that, are you going to tell them anything? So these are natural ways, and Krishna covers all these aspects, body, mind, and spirit, you know, that we can fully encompass, that fully encompass the process of submission and engaging everything in Krishna's service. At least that's my interpretation. Okay, Hare Krishna. Yes.
This was on verse 23, where it says on page 427, those who are devotees of other gods and who worship them with faith actually worship only me, O son of Kunti, but they do so in a wrong way. And in the purport, the last line in the purport said, in other words, Krishna does not approve the unnecessary worship of the demigods. Mm-hmm. So the question that came up was that, then why do the gopis worship Katyayani?
Not unnecessary. It says the unnecessary does not approve the unnecessary worship of the demigods.
Yeah.
That's not unnecessary. The gopis worship, you can worship demigods, that's not the point, but it's why you're worshiping them. See, unnecessary means everything's coming from Krishna anyway, and he explains that in the 7th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, that even when somebody, sataya sharya yuktas tasya ardhanami hate labate chattata kaman mayaiva vihitan hitan, yo yo yam yam tanum bhakta shari architamichiti tasya tasya chalam shadham tameva vidya vididhamyaham. That if someone worships the demigods, not only is Krishna the one supplying the goods that are coming from demigods, he even makes the faith in the, he's the one who steadies the faith of the worshipper so that he can worship. So the point is that if one understands that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead and is worshiping a demigod or offering obeisance to a demigod in proper perspective, that, you know, they're also servitors of Krishna. They're doing their job, you know, in the hierarchy. And they're limbs of, you know, Krishna's body in the universal form, Adidaiva. Then this is not a vidhi, it's not against the rules. But if someone's trying to bypass, you know, and bribe the demigods so that they can get some kind of enjoyment in the material world, this is a vidhi. And it's unnecessary because everything comes from Krishna. In the case of the gopis, this is, it's part of the lila, actually. But in that lila, you'll see that what are the gopis asking for when they go to Goddess Katyayani? They're asking, please, I want Krishna as my husband.
Yes.
You know, they're asking. But they ask everyone. When the gopis go through the forest, they're asking the trees and the creepers and the plants and anyone they can, you know, get their audience is like, where's Krishna? Can you please, you know, tell him? You know, and Radharani sees a bee flying. She, you know, first she chastises him and says she thought the bee was coming from Krishna. Said, you're an unreliable servant of an unreliable master. And then the bee flew away. She said, no, wait, come back. She said, please go tell Krishna that, you know. And so the mood of the gopis and devotees in Vraj when they're worshiping demigods is altogether different. Their only occupation in Vrindavan actually is to worship Krishna. But it's kind of like, you know, they go to church on Sunday and they worship Narayan. You know, so they have Shalagram Shila and they worship Narayan, but actually their heart and soul is Krishna, but they don't think of him as God. They never see him as God because he's just the most lovable object, the most, you know, the cynosure of their lives, the center of everything. They can't live without him. They can't breathe without him. Pranatakaruna. They're always thinking of Krishna, and they go on with these other kinds of rituals, which are just sort of part of the landscape.
And in that same context, two more examples were given. One was that in Vrindavan, Krishna actually tells everybody to pray to Vishnu and not to Indra, which was the right thing, like don't go to demigod and come go to Vishnu. But on the other hand, he also asked Arjun to pray to Shivji to get the Pashupas. So was it part of the Leela or was it his way of glorifying his
devotee? This is a way of glorifying Lord Shiva, who's his great devotee.
That's what I thought too. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Shrivas Pandit Prabhu is about to speak.
Just to add to what you said, even the gopis, when they were in searching for Krishna during the Rasleela and Krishna assumed the four-handed form, they all bow down and then they asked Narayan himself, like, you know, have you seen Krishna? To that extent, their love was there. So they were worshipping anybody and everybody, including Lord Narayan, just to get Krishna, just to add to the point you made. Thank you, Prabhuji.
And thank you. The Vaishnavas, they respect everyone. Mumukshavo Gaura Rupan Hitva Bhuta Patinata Narayana Kalashanta Bhajanti Yanasuyava. They're Anasuyava. The devotees are unenvious. They don't envy anyone. They don't therefore disrespect the demigods. Mumukshavo Gaura Rupan Hitva. They give up Hitva Bhuta Patinata. There are all kinds of millions and millions of forms of demigods for performing different universal affairs, but the devotees don't go there to those demigods for anything. Understanding the source is Krishna, but they don't disrespect them also. Rajasthama prakritaya samashila bhajanti vai pitri bhuta bhajesha din shriyeshvarya bhajepsavaha. Bhagavatam Sutta Goswami says, people who are in rajas and tamas, they're affected by lower modes of material. Rajasthama prakritaya samashila. Because they're in that same mode of rajas and tamas, they have the same mode of worship. Samashila bhajanti vai pitrir bhuta pajesha. Then they worship all kinds of different entities to try to fulfill their desires, which are stimulated by the modes of passion and ignorance. Pitrir means the forefathers. A lot of countries I go to in the Far East, people worship forefathers like anything. It's a big thing. In Japan, China, there's barely any land in Japan, but they use a lot of it for worshiping the forefathers. And Pitr Bhuta Pajesha Adin, other living entities they worship. And
I'm curious to know, when they worship the ancestors, do they have deities of ancestors or their grandparents? Who do they worship in Japan and countries like that?
I don't know precisely, but I do know that the Buddhists have very, very tight control over the population, because people really feel that if they don't do the ritual exactly right, then, you know, their relatives are going to burn in hell and suffer and all kinds of things. And it's really expensive. So most of the priests are really rich because it's a necessity. And then you have to pay rent on these funeral plots where they go for propitiating your forefathers and ancestors. But it's pretty common. But Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is saying that see the source, where everything's coming from. And ultimately in Bhagavatam we hear Devarshi Bhutapna Nirnam Pitranam Nakinkaro Nayam Nranicharajan Sravatmanaya Sharanam Sharanyam Kato Mukundam Parihritakartam. If someone has surrendered to Krishna completely, and he's no longer in debt to any, it's actually a fact that we're in debt to many other kinds of living entities. It's not that we shouldn't worship them or we shouldn't give to them, because we owe the demigods. And Deva Rishi, this verse says Deva means the demigods. Demigods they're supplying air, light, water, balance. There's all kinds of things that they're doing. The material body is an endowment, and it's regulated by forces beyond our control. Do you believe that? I mean, I go on every day taking it for granted until my hearing goes out, and then what happened to my hearing? It's like, you no longer have the privilege of hearing anymore, sir. Your hearing is gone. Or your eyesight, and it's just, I can see, I just take it for granted. Can you show me God? And then if your optical nerve is severed or, some disease comes, you've lost the privilege of seeing. We're entirely dependent. And if the sun, which is providing light, is not present, we can't see anything anyway. So we're fully dependent on the devas. And, this is much overlooked in material consciousness, just as much as everything else is overlooked for the sake of gratifying the senses, and we forget about where things are coming from. Actually, we're being supplied at every minute. We should live in gratitude. This is one of the lessons of the Vedas, is understand that we're dependent, and those who are providing for us are us, giving us services all the time, and you have to pay for them. You can't just take them for free, just as much as you can't take your electricity at home for free. Can you? Do you get a bill? I get a bill. And if you don't pay the bill, they just shut it right off. And so Deva, Rishi, and then the Rishis, they've given knowledge that's being passed down that we owe them, that we have a debt. There should feel a debt of gratitude. Devarshi, Bhutapna, Nrinam, Pitrinam, and then there's all kinds of living entities. There are cows, for instance, who provide milk. Everyone drinks milk. It's in everything. Everyone puts things, makes things with milk, grows up on milk. As soon as you stop taking the breast milk, then children, they drink cow milk. So we're indebted to the cow. And there are hundreds and hundreds of living entities that contribute to the process of our lives, to our survival. Nrinam means the other human beings. Pitranam means the forefathers. It means you wouldn't be here if it wasn't for your forefathers. And, they may have passed down an inheritance to you and all kinds of other things that you get. We've been given something. So you're a nrini, means you're a debtor. You owe. As soon as you're born, you owe. Devarshi bhutatna nrinam pitranam Kinkaro Nayam Rani Charajan. But Sarvatmana Ya Sharanam Sara. Sarvatmana means with one's whole self. Sarvatmana Ya, that person who, Sharanam Sharanyam, is surrendered to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That person who gives up everything and says, okay, I surrender to Krishna. It's much of the point of the ninth chapter, isn't it? Then, Kato Mukundam Pariyahritakartam, that person no longer is a debtor. No longer obligated to all these other entities because it's gone to the source. And this is pointed out, Krishna's pointing this out in the ninth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Gama visha chabutani daryam yahamojasa pushnami chausadi sarva somu bhutva rasatmakaha. He talks about how I'm also ahamhi sarva yajnanam. I'm the source of the sacrifice, the enjoyer of the sacrifices. Pitaham asya jagato mata data pitamaha. What is it? Omkara riksamayajra evacha. Dejam pavitram omkara riksamayarja devacha gatur bharta prabhu sakshi nivasa sharanam sukhrit pralava pralayastanam nidhanam bijamavyam. So he's naming all these things. Everything's coming from me. I'm the mother, I'm the father, I'm the grandfather, I'm all these things. You know, so if one is dedicated to Krishna, then no longer a debtor. And Krishna showed that in the pastime of lifting Govardhan Hill when all the residents of Vrindavan were getting ready to perform an Indra Yajna, and he came along as a little boy and just said to his father, "Why are you doing this? Rain comes anyway. What do you need Indra for? Just perform perform Yajna. It rains on the ocean too, you know. Rains on the rocks over there." So why don't you worship Govardhan Hill? At least we're getting grass and it's taking care of the cows and there's waterfalls there and everything. So then Indra became angry. Anything else about chapter 9? There's more lingering somewhere? Okay. Yes.
We also had a discussion on how samoham sarva bhuteshu, how Krishna is saying he's seemingly impartial, but then he immediately qualifies it saying that I am partial to my devotees. Mm-hmm. So how is it Krishna being impartial?
Well, it's natural. It's natural that, and it's a, this is considered not a fault, but it's an ornament of Krishna, that he's bhaktivatsala. In fact, it's his greatest ornament, that he's, and lucky for us, I mean, lucky for those who are devotees, that it's, you know, he's tender-hearted. And sadhanam hridayam mayam, sadhanam hridayam toham, maranyat te najanati mameva. You can look it up. This is, he says that devotees are in my heart. I'm always in their hearts. And not even for a fraction of a second do I forget my devotees, nor do they forget me. This is Krishna's preoccupation, actually, is reciprocating with his devotees. That's his preoccupation. That's what he's interested in. Everything else is boring. Page 246 in the Shloka book. Sarvo riyam mayam sadhanam riyam swaham madanyate na jananti naham tebhyo managapi. The pure devotee is always within the core of my heart, and I'm always in the heart of the pure devotee. My devotees do not know anything else but me, and I do not know anyone else but them. But of course, Prahlad Maharaj, in his teachings to his classmates, has really made an issue of Krishna being equal. Right? He talks so much about how Krishna is equal to everybody, and it appears that he's favorable to one and not to another. Much the way, the high court judge, somebody gets an award. He comes in the court, and first guy comes in, and he says, "Okay, that's your third strike. It's California. Third strike, you're out. You're going to jail for life. That's it. Gong, gong, and take him away." And then the next person comes in and says, "Oh, looked at your case. Okay, you're awarded $1 million. Take it and go." And, you know, outside the courtroom, someone might say, "Well, the judge favored you. He gave you $1 million. But the judge is impartial. He didn't favor the person with $1 million. The person who was apparently favored to take $1 million was in a position to be awarded $1 million. And the person that was sent to jail for life had caused that reaction himself, because of his activities. Mandatory sentence. He goes to jail. Therefore, Krishna is impartial, but those, he says, who reciprocate with me, I reciprocate also. Ye yata mam prapadyante tamstataiva bhajamyaham. Mama Vart Madhavartante Manusha Partha Sarvasha. He says, everyone's on my path. It's just that some people are asking for all kinds of harmful things. And other people want me. And other people just want to serve me. And those who by good fortune develop this propensity for serving Krishna with no other motive, to those devotees, Krishna is inclined to reciprocate in a very special way. Yoga kshemam bahamyaham means he personally comes. I mean, what else would he do? That's how they've come to him in such a unassailing way, in a guileless way. They're coming to worship Krishna, therefore he reciprocates. So in another sense, Srivas Pandit Prabhu was gone, but in another sense, he's impartial. It's natural. The sun is shining on the lotus garden, and we can't stand it without your presence here, so it's very difficult. The sun shines down on the lotus garden, and it opens up the lotus flowers, and the bees come in, and they take the honey. Well, it's not honey, but there's something in there that's nice for the bees. And at other times, when it's dark, it closes. And someone might say that they want him on the other side now. You're wanted everywhere, Srivas Pandit. So then, it's not that the sun is the friend or the enemy of the bees. The sun is doing its job. It opens the lotus flower, it closes the lotus flower. The bees are just there. They take or they don't take according to how the lotus flowers open or closed. So in that sense also, Krishna is impartial. He's there providing for everyone. The sun is there for everyone, but if you go in your room, close the door, close all the windows, and close all the shades, you're not going to get any sunshine, right? So similarly, Krishna's mercy is available to everyone. Queen Kunti said this. But if you don't take advantage of it, it's not Krishna's fault. And in the Bhagavad Gita, in the fifth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna makes very clear that the kinds of reactions that we get in the material world have nothing to do with him. Has to do with our relationship with the three modes of material nature. Nakartritvam nakarmani lokasasujati prabhu. Nakarma palasam yogam sabhavastu pravartate. He says, I don't create the fruits of action. The living entity doesn't create the fruits of action. He also doesn't create activity. Nor does he cause other people to act. But all this is enacted by the three modes of material nature. Nadate kaschitit papam, nachayva sukritam vibhu. Sukritam vibhu. Krishna says that the vibhu, or the Supreme Personality of God, also is not responsible for the suffering and enjoyment of the living entity in the material world. What's it caused by? It's caused by ignorance. Jnanina tadagyanam yesham nashitam atmana tesham aditya vajjnanam prakasha yati tat param. But when one gets knowledge, then it's like the sun. It lights up everything. Like the sun lights up everything in the daytime. So when we get knowledge, then that ignorance is destroyed, and then we come back to our original condition of being able to take full advantage of Krishna's mercy. So Krishna is impartial, but he shows special partiality to those who approach him in a certain way. Rakshit Jariwala Prabhu.
This partiality that Krishna shows and the mercy that he shows to his devotees, are we to take it that mercy is just for the so-called spiritual life of the devotee and not so much for his physical life or his body? Example, when devotees have accidents and they perish like that. There is a verse which we also discussed the other day, the Bhakti Shastri class, and I may just refer to it, where Krishna is saying, that's 931, He quickly becomes righteous and attains lasting peace. O son of Kunti, declare it boldly that my devotee never perishes. And we know that accidents happen to devotees, even very advanced devotees. We heard recently about this chanter in Vrindavan who, in a flash, went away. Such a dedicated soul, there singing 24 hours a day in the temple. There was an explosion and he's gone. He's Krishna's devotee. Are we to take it that it doesn't matter because it's only the body that has perished? His spiritual form is protected and he will be given in the next life the same type of support that he was given here for his spiritual advancement. That really the body doesn't matter. Are we to take it that he says that my devotee doesn't perish, he doesn't promise that his current life that he's living won't perish, it can go in an accident. What is not going to perish is possibly his spiritual state of development.
Shall I answer? Two words. Of course. Yeah, it's not referring to the body. It's the body will go one way or the other. So it's not that, one becomes, Krishna, when he's saying, Shri Pram Pavati Dharmatma Shashvas Chantim Nagajit, Konti Aparti Janihi Nami Bhakti Pranash, my devotee will never be vanquished, that the body will be preserved somehow, some way. Krishna can do, first of all, the devotee, feels Krishna can do whatever he likes in whatever way. And the body's not going to persevere no matter what we do. And it's going to go one way or another. In fact, great devotees like King Kulshekhar praise that, take my body now while I'm thinking of you, because then I have a much better chance of going back to Godhead. Otherwise, I could be caught unaware sometime and not be able to think of you. So this, the preservation of the body, there is no preservation of the body. It's not us anyway. It will be vanquished one way or another. But Krishna carries what we lack and he preserves what we have. The case of Bharat Maharaj, he was a great devotee on a very advanced platform of devotional service. He had come all the way to the position of what's called bhava. Adau shraddha tata sada sangata bhajana kriya tato narta nivritti syat tato nishta ruchi tato bhava, which means it's past ruchi. It's very, he's gone through many, many stages of advancement in devotional service. He's come to bhava. Bharat Maharaj was so advanced in devotional service. He was a young king. He had a whole kingdom of a beautiful wife and all the wealth in the world, practically. And he walked away from it for the sake of spiritual advancement. Went to the forest to sit down. That's how advanced he was. His eyes were, moist with tears throughout the day because of his attachment to the Supreme Lord and feelings of separation. And he was performing very regulated kind of yoga when he became distracted in his practice by deer. Easy to do. I was just walking through Muir Woods last Wednesday night, and we saw a deer, and everyone rushed over there to see the deer. Because the deer, you look at it, even Sita was attracted by the deer and told Ram, please, can I have that deer? It's a no-no. But so anyway, he got distracted by a baby deer. That's even more treacherous. You see a baby deer, you can't resist. So he couldn't resist. He became attracted to the baby deer, and he lost his meditation on Narayan. And when he left his body, it was by an accident. He gave up his body. Next life, by Krishna's grace, he carried over the remembrance. Even in the deer body he took birth in the next life, he was able to remember that, I blew it. I was Bharat in the previous birth. I had achieved this advanced position. I was meditating and I became distracted, focused on a deer. Now here I have a deer body. So what did he do? That little deer went to back to Pulastya Ashram, where all the sadhus were, so he could associate with sadhus, and he started bathing several times a day. Little deer performing Ashtanga yoga, eating leaves and things like that. And then after he gave up the deer body, then he got another chance in the body of Jadbharat, great Paramahamsa. And this body, he acted like he was retarded, so that no one would bother him. His father was a Brahmin. His father tried to teach him how to perform Brahminical activities, to wash after he had passed and gone to the restroom, and he would do it. He would wash before he went, and then neglect after. He did everything opposite. He gave him this upanayam, this Brahminical initiation thread, and it just became black. And he acted like that so that he didn't have to interact with the outside world. And actually, it was revealed later on when he met Maharaj Rahugana that he was a great liberated Paramahamsa soul. So Krishna's carrying what we lack and preserve what we have. It may come in different ways. And also, you know, the devotee may even suffer some physical hardship in this lifetime. It's not that the devotee is immune from physical hardship, but even amidst that, there are, you know, several things that happen. One is that, like Bhishma Dev was on the battlefield. He was shot through and through with arrows. That's got to be painful. I mean, even one arrow is really hard to take, but he withstood that and spoke spiritual wisdom in the presence of Krishna and all the other devotees, spoke to Yudhishthira, enlightened him at the last moments of his life. Srila Prabhupada, same thing. He was, when we saw Prabhupada's condition, the devotees would cry because he had become so emaciated. He was just skin and bones. He stopped eating before he left his body. He never stopped doing his service. He was lying there in Vrindavan on his bed, and you can see the film of it. They're holding the dictaphone above him, and they have the book, Pradyumna, the Sanskrit editor's holding the Bhagavatam so he can, you know, keep translating and giving his commentaries on the Bhagavatam to his last breath. Devotees, you know, may come into all kinds of physical anomalies one way or another. But they go on. Who is Sri Krishna Purushottam's spiritual master who was just here recently? Huh? Bhakti Raghava Swami was just here. And, you know, he always had one bad leg. He had one bad leg. And in Mayapur, there was some dacoits came and tried to, you know, they're terrorists. They attacked many years ago. I remember this. I wasn't there, but I heard about it. But he was living in Mayapur, and one of them threw a bomb, and it blew off one of Bhakti Raghava Maharaj's legs. Which leg? The good leg. And what did he say? Well, you know, he just got right back, did his devotional service, nothing. And you see him, he just, you know, he walks around the world with no concern for what his physical condition is. He's not connected to the physical body in that way. He's concerned with one thing, and that's his devotional service. So devotees are not naiva kinchit karomi ti yukto manyiti tattva vit pashyan shrinvan sprishan jigran ashnan gachan shupan shusan pralapan vishranan grinnan unmishan nimishan api indriyan indriyateshu vartanta iti dharayan. Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, the devotee doesn't relate to the outer body. Not at all. Naiva kinchit, nothing. Karomiti, whether he's moving about, breathing, seeing, smelling, that the external body is. He thinks all these things are going on, but that's not me. Long answer to a short question. Ramananda Saka?
I was just going to say that it seems that aside from the body not being important, also the timing of a devotee leaving the earth is also unimportant. Someone may be involved in very intense and very dedicated devotional service, but Krishna could take that person at any time.
That's true. And may I just make a slight amendment to what you just said as far just the wording, because the body is important. Nridehaṁ ajyam sulabham sudulabham plavam sukalpam guru karnadaram. Or labham sudulabham idam bahusambhavanti manusham artadam anityam apihadhira. So this Bhagavatam verse, labham sudulabham idam, it says that it's very rare to get the human body. And anityam, it's temporary. It's very temporary. But it's artadam, it's very valuable. So although it's temporary, it's extremely valuable. And the other verse, which I said first, rinam adyam suladam sulabham sudulabham, because it's a boat. The human body is a special boat it's made to go across the material ocean, take us to the other side, to the spiritual world. It's equipped for that. So it's important, but it's temporary. I know that's what you meant, but I just thought I'd throw, you know.
Regarding the modes of natural nature, you mentioned that Krishna is not responsible for activities, nor the results of the activities. All this is done by the modes of material nature. What are these modes of material nature? Are these just like properties of the material nature? Or
actually, what the modes of material nature are a perverted reflection of the energies of the spiritual world. You'll read about this in the very beginning part of the Brahma Sanhita. The material world is a... and also in the Bhagavad Gita, of course, your 15th chapter will take you right there, describing the banyan tree, which is, you know, it's an inversion. The spiritual world is there, and then the 360 degrees, the material world is a 180 degree reflection of the spiritual world. So in the spiritual world, you have these energies of... Khladini, Samvit, and Sundini. The Khladini energy, of which you are actually a part of that Sundini energy. That Khladini energy, the bliss energy. That's why your only drive in life is to find happiness, actually. That's the Khladini potency of the spiritual world. Khladini, Sundini, and Samvit. Samvit is the... the knowledge potency, Sundini, is the potency which maintains and sustains all the forms of the spiritual world. So those energies, when they become perverted in the material world, they become sattva, rajas, and tamas. And Jiva Goswami says, hlada tapachaya. The energy in the spiritual world which gives the highest pleasure, perverted in the material world, is the cause of our greatest suffering. What's happiness there becomes suffering here. It's a reflection. You get the opposite of effect, actually. Hlada tapachaya. So those three modes of material nature transferred here. And the transfer takes place because of misuse of independence of the living entity. Here we go. Anyway... that living entity who becomes separated from Krishna is entangled by the three modes of material nature. But that's not Krishna's choice. That's the choice of the living entity.
Are these the perverted reflections, that is the modes of material nature? Are they... like a conscious beings. I mean, because when we do something, there is a reaction, and there are so many intricacies of action and reaction, and that is happening exactly as per one's karma. So that means that everything is done by a conscious being. It's not just done by inert matter. So from that...
Well, in the sense that, you know, it's created by a conscious being and maintained by a conscious being. Mayadhyakshena prakriti suyate sacharacharam. Krishna says, because of my glance, it's all going on. And prakrite kriyamanani gunai karmani sarvasha. It's like a machine working. And so there's somebody behind the machine, definitely. You know, if you get stuck your hand in a machine accidentally somewhere, that there's somebody to sue behind. You're going to sue somebody. Who made the machine or set it up or whatever. There's somebody behind it. So the material nature is like that. it's mechanical. You look at a bird. Bird pops around and it eats seed and it does things. It's got a there's a soul inside there, but it's controlled in a certain way by modes of material nature. So are we. We have certain propensities according to the modes of material nature that we're driven by. Oh, good. You have a question or comment?
Yeah, a follow-up question. Basically, I also want to try. Basically, I also have the confusion about modes of material nature because it refers to the external forces also and also modes of material nature as it refers to the soul. In the sense, soul also can have modes of material nature like passion. It can be, we sometimes say that we all are in a mode of goodness, passion. So there is something which soul also exhibits something and there's something.
No. The soul is just like, take this example from the 13th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita where Krishna says, air never mixes with anything. You can put it through water, it won't mix. You can put it through mud, it won't mix. You can put it anywhere, it comes out eventually. It may look like it's in there, but it's not. It's separate. It's a separate element. It'll come back out again. So similarly, he says, the soul, although ensconced in matter, it doesn't actually mix with matter, ultimately, only by identification. So it's our identification with the modes of material nature. It's not that we are the modes of material nature or the soul is, mixed with the material nature. It's that we identify with the material nature and therefore we're controlled by it. Maya mugda jivaranahi swata krishna gyan. We become overwhelmed by ignorance, and thus we go on automatic control by the three modes of material nature until it's not swata, it's not automatically that we come out, but jivara kripaya koi Krishna Veda Puran. Therefore, Veda Vyas came and he put the Vedas down, and Prabhupada came and said, distribute books, because that way people can come out. They can get some knowledge and begin the process of purification. Partiva dharano dumas tasman agnis trayimaya tamasastu rajastasmat satvam yad brahmadarshanam. The whole human project is to purify oneself of the effects of the modes of material nature gradually, step by step, to come to the point of sattva-gun, where you can have your own volition. Otherwise, you're just controlled. Mode of passion means you have to run after one thing after another after another. Sattva-gun, you get some kind of independent choice. From there, you can prosecute spiritual life, execute spiritual life. So we're covered by the modes. We're covered by the modes. Nitya Siddha Krishna Prema Satya Kabunoi Shravanadi Shuddha Chitte Kare Udoy. Means Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said that we are what we are. We're a manifestation of the spiritual energy. We're one of Krishna's potencies, his internal potency. That's who we are. But we get covered by the modes of material nature, by matter. Shravanadi Shuddhachitte, the process of purification comes when we hear the spiritual sound vibration. It reawakens us, it purifies us from the modes of material nature. And then our real proclivities as an eternal servant of Krishna comes out.
I was going to say, is it right then to say that it's the subtle body that goes into the modes of material nature? Like the mind and the intelligence, they are in those three modes.
Asau gunamayer bhaver bhuta sukshmendriyatman vitsva nirmiteshu nirvishto bhunte bhuteshu tad gunan. The verse in the first canto, second chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, that, the material subtle body and gross body are the place of residence for the soul. But all of it doesn't work until the super soul enters and causes the soul to enjoy the effects of the three modes of material nature based on its desire. Asau gunamayer bhaver bhuta sukshmendriyatmabhi. There's a subtle force of desire that comes from the soul, and that the super soul must be there to fulfill the desire of the individual soul. And your question was different. You said, is it the gross body or the subtle body?
I was saying that since the soul is unchangeable, the soul cannot move from one state to another state. Like soul right now is in the mode of passion and is in the mode of goodness and so on, because soul doesn't change. So what is it that is in the in one mode versus another mode at different points of time? Is it our subtle body? Is it our mind and intelligence?
Well, Atma is described as body, mind, and spirit also. It's all because we become so interrelated with both the subtle and the gross body that practically they become indistinguishable. Both are there. More importantly is the subtle body, because that's what transfers from one gross body to the next body. We know that from the 15th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna says, Ukramantam stitam vapi bunjanam vagunan vitam. Vimudanan upashanti pashanti gyana chakshusha. Shotram chakshu sparshanam cha rasanam granam evacha. Adishtayam manaschayam vishayan upasevate. So that this subtle body is moving like the wind that goes across a field and it picks up the smell of grass, and then it's grass wind. So we move across different modes of material nature. Purusha prakriti stohi bhunte prakriti jan gunan karanam guna sango sya. Because of our sangha, our association with the gunas in different ways, we pick up, you know, we become affected by that. And there are cases where the subtle body is the only thing there. In the case of what people call ghosts, they're mentioned in Srimad Bhagavatam and the parts of the Vedas. The subtle body, if there are instances where somebody's outside, well, you do this every night when you leave, when you sleep, you know, you can separate yourself from the gross body. And you come back in after you fly around and you run around a field somewhere and you're being chased by tigers, you win $1 million, and then you wake up and there you are back in your ghost body and you got bills to pay and no $1 million either. And then sometimes if the gross body is lost under certain circumstances, then one can live in a subtle body. And even when there's, it's described in the fifth canto, very unpalatable subject, but hellish punishment is enacted upon the subtle body, because it can withstand unlimited kinds of stimulation from different points of view. The bodies are coverings of the soul, actually. We have original senses, mind senses, and it gets covered over. Like, you know, if I feel this cloth here, how much can I feel? But if I put a glove on, then how much do I feel? What if I put two or three or four or five gloves on and I feel here? Six gloves. In fact, I heard from somebody the other day about if with diabetes, people lose the feeling in their feet. And the reason they lose their legs eventually is because they walk around, they step on something and it gets infected and they get gangrene and then they have to cut their foot off and then their leg, because you can't feel it. So the soul, what are we feeling actually? We're covered over. We're not feeling anything. We're just getting a little tactile sensation through our gross material senses. And we enjoy it through the subtle mind. But actually, the person who's the real experiencer is the soul. And that's that investment in hearing and chanting in bhakti, it actually is developing our original senses. They're becoming purified. Sarvapadi vinir muktam taprat vena nirmalam rishikena rishikesha sevanam bhakti. Do you have a question?
Yes, Prabhuji.
Okay, go ahead.
Maybe once you're done. So, Prabhuji, you said that there is soul, there is a subtle body and gross body, and then the super soul enters that and activates the soul to enjoy the effects of modes of nature. So does it mean that, in that sense, the effects of karma is karma and modes of nature the same? Or? Yeah.
Yes. So, for instance, at the end of the universe, Hare Krishna, at the end of the universe, everything gets wound back up again into Mahavishnu. All the souls, in fact, there's a little description of that. Forget what I'm originally saying, but it's described in the Bhagavatam about how Sankarshan, near the end of the universe, he starts to get angry that so many souls, he's been giving mercy and distributing knowledge and everything like that for a long time, and nobody's taken advantage of it. They're still like, nah, I'm all right. I'm all set. Not interested. And so he becomes a little angry at this, and then from his eyebrows spring the 11 Rudras come out, and they start doing their dance of destruction to burn down the universe. Anyway, all the souls then merge back into the body of the Mahavishnu, which is described in the Brahma Samhita, the whole process. Yashyaika nishvasita kala mata valambya jivanti loma vilajajagananata Vishnur Mahan sahiya vashn ihayasya kala visheshu govindamari purushanta mahamajami. He's breathing in and out, and these cycles of creation and destruction are taking place. So the souls who are enjoying in this perpetual process, going from one birth to death over and over again in the material world, at the end, you know, the music stops and it all gets wound back up into Mahavishnu, and the soul's in a state of susupti, or a dreamless sleep, like you don't even know that you exist practically. This is the, like, when you get knocked out by, when you go to have an operation, they give you these, you know, anesthetics that just, you know, knock you out. They cut your leg off. You have no idea. And so you're in the body of Mahavishnu like that. When Mahavishnu breathes back out again, then the soul gets remanifested according to its previous karma and based on its desire. And Krishna is the one who's there, who reminds. Sarvasya chaham hridi sannivishto mattak smritir gyanam apoanam cha. He reminds the soul, oh, by the way, you wanted to do this. This is where you left off. And he takes up again in that cycle of enjoyment. Long answer to a short question. But that's how it's described. So, another one?
One quick clarification I needed, that after destruction and when the remanifestation happens, does it start at the same point? For example, right now if there is a destruction and if there is a manifestation again, will we start with this class? Like I'll be sitting here asking this question.
Maybe we already did. And this is we wouldn't know the difference. Well, there is a process that's described how from the navel of Mahavishnu comes, of Garbhadakshay Vishnu, grows the lotus stem. And from that stem, within the stem of the lotus that grows from the navel of Vishnu is the repository of all living entities in the material world. They're all within the stem of that lotus. And then Brahma is born on top of the lotus, on the whorl of the lotus, and he's born into ignorance, darkness. And then he, searching for his origin, very intelligent being, eventually he begins to pray to Krishna. He hears, tapastam tapayetena tavasiddhir bhavishyati, take this tapasya and you'll get perfection. And in Brahma Samhita, the account is that a goddess Saraswati comes. Uvacha puratastasmai tasya divya Saraswati kama krishnaya govinda he gopi jani itibi. And says, here, chant this mantra and you'll attain the perfection. So he begins performing tapasya, chanting the mantra, and then he becomes enlightened. And then you'll notice at the last verse of the Brahma Samhita that Krishna is instructing him, because Brahma has some passion to create. So Krishna is engaging him to recreate, make a sub-creation. The elements are already created by Vishnu, but then Brahma is the sub-creator, so he comes in. It's like contractor, you know. And he employs all the other subcontractors to to rebuild the universe, and the living entities come out gradually within, you know, their particular places. Do they start off exactly, you know, where they left off? That's kind of like, sounds like a, there used to be a TV show when I was a kid called Twilight Zone. It sounds like something like that. I never thought of it that way. But there's no mention of that, you know, it's you know, you take your general proclivity from your last life. It's a long time, too, you know, from one creation to the next for the soul. It's big, big traumatic change. Yes, Rakshit? I was wondering
whether one of the verses in the 15th chapter might be relevant, which talks about the conception that one had in the previous life. According to that conception, in the next life, one is going to get a certain body, a certain mouth, a certain feature. That one is carrying that conception from one life to the other, just like the air is carrying aromas. And so that conception would have to do something with desires, unfulfilled desires, or desires that one had in a certain life, and that life was extinguished. And the soul then got demanifested. Now it manifests again. It takes on with that conception where it left off. Wonder yeah. whether that would be relevant.
Well, of course, it's very relevant. And it's, you know, when we leave this body, this present gross body, we don't have any say in where we're going in our next life. Karmana dhaivane trena jantur deho papate striya pravishta udanam pumsareta ganashraya. I may be a big fat American right now, and I may be born as an American again, but, you know, as an American tree that gets chopped down or something like that. It's not under my control how I get remanifested. It's up to Daiva, higher authority. Huh? Yeah. But, you know, karma's a law. You know, there's laws, and you could try to follow the laws to your best ability. I mean, we just depend on Krishna. Rakshit Prabhu brought this up earlier as far as leaving the body. The time we leave, the method we leave, the devotee depends on Krishna. This is brought up in the 8th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, which is called Attaining the Supreme. And yogis have very specific, you know, idea about when to leave the body and the circumstances under which they leave the body so that they can attain higher destination. You know, it's kind of scientific. It's very scientific, actually, you know, according to the way the modes of nature work, the smoke, the night, the smoke. There are apparently smoke deities or something. There's all these ideas about, you know, when to leave, when not to leave. But Krishna says, the devotee doesn't care. Naite sriti parta janam. What's the rest? Yogi muyati kashchana. Tasmat sarvishu skaleshu. Tasmat yogi bhavarjuna. So the bhakti yogi doesn't try to calculate all these things. He just depends on Krishna when he's leaving. And so you know, how we leave and that, you know, the karmakandis, the yogis, they try to calculate all these things. And it's not so easy either. Like in the Srimad Bhagavatam, there's the story of King Nriga, who had ideas about, you know how to work the modes of material nature. He was a karmakandi, and he knew that if he gave away charity, certain kinds of charity to certain kinds of people, he would get this kind of good karma. And that's what he did. He just gave away so much charity to so many Brahmins. But he made some mistakes in the process, inevitable. And because of that, when it came time for his punishment and reward, you know, there was punishment along with the reward. The material world's all mixed up. You can't, you know, you can't take the good without the bad being mixed in. So the devotee realizes that and just surrenders to Krishna and depends on him.
The chapter 2, around 40-45 words, is explaining to Bhagavan, explaining to Arjuna that the importance of nishkama karma, looking for any, not looking for any benefit, any fruitive activity, and that way the true meaning of yoga as life. And I was just reading that today, so I thought.
Could you read the verse?
There are several of them. I think it's starting from around 40. But it is came to that perform your duty.
What page are you on?
That is page 122.
Okay.
Verse 48, chapter 48, verse 48.
Go ahead.
Perform your duty, ekpost, Arjuna, abandoning all attachment to success or failure. Such equanimity is called yoga.
Okay, that was it? Yeah.
I was saying that chapter is explaining more about the work you're doing. You are not the controller for the result or the benefit.
Yeah. It solves all the problems of life. Understanding that I'm not the controller and giving up to Krishna.
Just a thought on what Shraddha Mataji said, that whether we'll be continuing in the next birth where we stopped. So it may not be because most of us would not be knowing what we would be in the next birth, particularly because of the Bhagavad Gita shloka that says, Yam yam vapis maran bhavam tejatyante kalevaram tam tam evaiti kaunteya sadatat bhava bhavitaha. So we would not be knowing what we would be thinking at the time of death. So we would be taking our next birth based on that. So we may not be able to continue with where we stopped, probably.
Yeah. Nice point. Nice citation. Thank you. Any other questions about chapter 9 or anything else?
Where it says that the mighty winds rest on the sky. So the question was, what is sky? Is it the same as... Are the words sky, ether,
yes,
and space considered to be the same? Are they all the three,
yes,
three the same thing?
Yes, okay. Ether and sky and space are
and
the same.
And space are the same thing.
Yes.
And also when we look out and see that sky, what is that sky that we see? Is it like one of the layers on the universe? Or is it just...
I don't know, what do you see?
I mean, like, you know, the blue thing that we see or which turns into a different color. Like when you look up, we see a blue sky, right?
Yeah.
So what is that? What is that?
Reflection of Krishna's beauty.
Okay. So is it something trickling from the Brahmajyoti into this universe, or what exactly is that?
Yeah. Any light that's coming in here is coming from Krishna, because Krishna is the source of all light. Yes.
Morning. I just happened to take a look at this Bhagavatam, one of the a chart in a cover page, and it is explaining more about what his Mataji was asking. Is it okay? I just take that and show that.
Yes. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Rama. You explain. Rama Rama Hare Hare. Hare Krishna Hare Krishna. Krishna Krishna Hare.
There is a chart about the expansion of the cover. And it's saying number one is the Goloka. And then it is in a lotus flower shape. And surrounded with the Brahma Jyoti. And sometimes in the Brahma Jyoti, I just read Swami. I'm just saying the same from my memory from the morning I read. From the Brahma Jyoti, sometimes the Mahatattva, the great elements, is coming like a clouds, and it creates a certain area that the Vishnu Tattva enter in there and creating the material world. And in the material world, when it is created, because it is away from the Brahma Jyoti, there is no sun. So therefore the sun and moon, the stars, need to create the environment and the lights in that Mahatattva. So it's explaining the way that how this the material world is created in this within the spiritual world, and how does that interact with the Vishnu Tattva.
Nice description. This sublime knowledge, it's coming down, passed down. This sun, it's a covered universe. There are earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, and false ego are the coverings of the universe, and each one is 10 times thicker than the one before. So it's vastly thick, and therefore it's covered walls of the universe. However, as Sunny was saying, within that universe we have a sun, which is illuminating. Deyam sada savriti mandalama divarti narayana sahasija sana sanivishtaha. Yakundalvan, anyway, the verse says from the Rig Veda that the within that sun is Lord Narayan. Narayan is there, and it's his effulgence, which is, you know, creating this unlimited source of energy, which is actually sustaining the universe. In the 13th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, we find Krishna mentions that the Supersoul is the source of light in all luminous objects. So any light that's coming here is coming from Krishna. There are spiritual planets within the material world. Dhruvaloka planet, for instance, is not subject to the laws of time like other bodies within the material world. And of course, there's a Shvetadvip within the material universe that the demigods, it's mentioned in the beginning of the Bhagavatam, the 10th canto, they go to pray to Krishna, the shore of the milk ocean, to ask him for help. It's amazing, astounding information. Shabda Brahma. It's the eyes can't see much, but the ears can accommodate a lot. And you can know about, you know, what's going on in Chicago. If we just called somebody right now, might wake them up, but they could tell us what the temperature is and what's going on there from the sound vibration. So similarly, this sound is passed down from the spiritual world. And by hearing it, we can understand what's the nature of the spiritual world and the material world. Maya sakta mana partha yogam yunjan marashaya asamsayam samagramam yatagyasasi tachchinu. Just by hearing, Krishna says, you can understand everything about the phenomenal and numinous worlds. Well, there it is. Is your first time here?
Yes.
Welcome. Where are you from?
Massachusetts.
Oh, I see. My name is Vaisheshi Gadas. What's your...
Donnie.
Did you go to the temple in Boston?
Yes, but not much.
What brings you to the temple here?
Actually, a friend of mine is also present.
I see.
Another devotee.
I see. Who's here tonight? Hare Krishna. Thank you. What's your name? Rupa Manjari. Hare Krishna. Welcome. Are you connected with the devotees in Massachusetts? Do you know Sankirtan Dasi? She and a devotee named Nitin are part of the Boston Temple, and they come here to visit regularly, so I thought I'd ask. Well, thank you for coming out for Rath Yatra. Do you all have a place to stay and everything? Oh, you are? Oh, that's great. Okay. Well, if there's anything we can do for you in the meantime, please let us know. Thanks for visiting. Hare Krishna. We have programs going on Saturday, and then Rath Yatra starts on Sunday at 11 o'clock. There's a map on the internet that tells how to get to the site, and we'll all be going down there, some of us anyway, to set up for the book tables for the book distribution. Okay. Los Angeles Rath Yatra was fantastic. We just came back from there, and we distributed more than 7,500 books during the parade. Hare Krishna. Thanks in a large part to Krishna Purushottam Prabhu and his crew who came down, including Deepak came down, Bharat came down. Who else did we have? Pallav came down. Manju came down. Where's Manju? Haribo! Bhakti and Elena came. We had a great team for distribution. And Jai Keshava headed up the team to pack all those 7,500 packs. 2 days, two long days of packing with a big team packing together. But it was nice. People loved the packs. They had two books. They had a Jagannath sticker, a little flyer about what is Rath Yatra, invitation to the temple, and a lollipop. They were really nice. Okay, so we're going to have Artik and Kirtan now, so we'll pause to put away all the books and asans as efficiently and quickly as possible, and then we'll stand up for the Artik ceremony. Srimad Bhagavad Gita ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Gopremanande Hari Hari Bo. Hare Krishna.